Over on Substack, the Unsolicited Advice Reading Group are reading some of Simone Weil's greatest essays. If you'd like to join us, the link is in the description. Right, Dr. Andrew Henry, aka Religion for Breakfast. Welcome to Solicited Advice.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful to have you. Thank you for coming on. There's been an awful lot of talk in the media and especially online about the possibility of a Gen Z religious revival. We've had this kind of narrative that religiosity has been declining generation on generation, but Gen Z is going to be the generation in the Western world to bring religion back and particularly bring Christianity back. You've done a fair amount of research around this. How much does this narrative hold up, if at all?
The short answer is the narrative doesn't hold up. A lot of this research is coming from the sociologist Ryan Burge, who writes over at Substack, Graphs on Religion. I highly recommend you check him out. And I recently did a video on this topic that dug into it. And no, there's not a Gen Z revival happening. When you look at the data from the past 30 years, past 40 years, there's been a steady decline in Christianity in the United States. We'll talk mostly about the U.S. We can talk about the U.K. context too. It looks like a ski slope. It was, you know, overwhelming affiliation, church attendance. When you measure prayer, Bible reading, it was you know 80% or higher in the U.S. in the mid 20th century, and it's now down to the low 60s in terms of affiliation, 63%. What has happened is a leveling off. So you look at that ski slope down to the low 60s. It's been bouncing around the low 60% range for a few years now. So the most we can say is that there is a plateau in religious disaffiliation in the United States. Does a religious plateau mean a revival? No. Because when you look at how religious change happens, it mostly happens through generational change. With each subsequent generation, fewer and fewer people affiliate, I guess we could say more and more people disaffiliate. So boomers, silent generation, high rates of affiliation, millennials, Gen Z, lower rates of affiliation, and that goes down with each generation. So in order to posit a revival, you would have to see massive increases back up to the levels of their parents. Gen Z would have to just reaffiliate in massive numbers. Millennials would have to reaffiliate in massive numbers in order to see that ski slope turn into a U-shaped graph. And when we look at a few years of plateau, if I was a betting man, I would not bet on that ski slope turning into a U-shape. Maybe it will stay at a plateau for the next decade, the next 20 years, who knows? But it seems unlikely.
And when people often trot out sort of studies that say that things like church attendance are up, like that's the thing that at least in the UK we hear a lot about, you know, more people are going to church every week. And this is supposed to be a kind of proxy signal for some kind of religious revival. How strong an indicator is this of increased religiosity? Or is this sort of a bad proxy measure?
Well, usually what's happening is, I mean, it's so much of it is media hype. So there's either poor studies that have been done. So there was this one group, it was like a Christian nonprofit in the UK had some wild number of like men reaffiliating or reattending church, Gen Z men from like 4% to 20% in just a few years.
Yes, that's the kind of thing that I had in mind.
Yeah, and I forget the exact group that did the study. This was very recent, it was like 2024. And I mean, that's bonkers. 4% to 20% is just this massive jump in a few years. But they use like online opt-in surveys. So just the methodology, I'm not a sociologist, but from what I've read, the methodology is not that great. The people that are already more likely to be attending church will decide to take this online survey. You're not really getting the fine-grained sort of sociological methods that are considered gold standard. The other thing that ends up happening is media spin, where you'll see something like Gen Z men more likely to attend church. But when you dig into the data, you're like, oh, Gen Z who are already attending church are more likely to attend church than millennials. Mm. And the difference is like attending church monthly 1.8 times versus 1.9 times. But you're just already measuring Gen Z men who already go to church. So it's not like you're looking at the general population of Gen Z men. So it's either bad data or spinning the data in such a way that make it sound like a revival. Dr. Burge put it this way, where he compared it to 9/11. So the 9/11 terrorist attacks, there was a brief resurgence in church attendance, and it lasted like a year, maybe two, and then went back down to baseline. And there was a lot of talk about, like, the assassination of Charlie Kirk last year, that this was creating some sort of revival. But when you compare the two, 9/11 to assassination, not to downplay an assassination, which is obviously horrible, but when you talk about, like, the direction of American history, 9/11 obviously has a larger impact. And even that wasn't enough to create a revival, just a short-lived spike in returning to church. So you would need just massive, like, something you would never, you literally have never seen in American history would have to happen in order to have the sort of revival that would bring Gen Z levels back up to previous generations in terms of reaffiliation.
And you say there's this kind of brief spike in church attendance after 9/11, and, you know, maybe the data will turn out there's a much more modest spike in the wake of things like Charlie Kirk's assassination. What kind of psychological factors tend to be driving this sort of, like, temporary kind of shadow religious resurgence that then fades away again in time?
I mean, that's a really big question. I don't have an easy answer to it. There have been some studies that show that instability, war, trauma, societal trauma can lead to increased religious ritual, increased reaffiliation. Whether that lasts for years or decades or generations, I think is yet to be seen. So there's a scholar at Harvard, Joe Henrich, who did a famous study on that's simply titled "War Makes People More Religious" or something like that. And he looked at several countries that suffered, like, horrible civil wars in the last few decades. It was like Tajikistan, I think Sierra Leone. There was like three or four countries that he studied, and there were measurable increases in religious reaffiliation and religious practice. So attending church services, prayer, stuff like that. There were measurable increases in those arenas after the civil wars ended. Now, again, I'd be curious, at this point, that study is maybe 6 or 7 years old. So if we went back and studied these, surveyed these countries again, has it gone back to baseline? I'm not sure. But there is some suggestive data that war makes people more religious, instability makes people more religious. So that could be a factor for 9/11. But again, that's an educated guess based on those studies that I know of.
And in order for this to culminate in a full-blown revival, say, this would need to be a kind of generational shift, you say. So we are not so much trying to look for these kind of little upticks. In order to demonstrate that there would be a full-blown revival, it would have to kind of persist along a generational gap. Am I kind of understanding that correctly?
I mean, just put it in sheer numbers. It's something like 18 million American Gen Z people would have to reaffiliate. 18 million. Like, it would just be... several New York cities would have to reaffiliate with Christianity in order to bring it back to baseline and bring it back to the previous generation's baseline. So it's just a massive amount of people. And I don't think it would be something that we would have to be debating. It would just be so obvious. So, and this is maybe a cynicism on my part, but I think it's wishful thinking. It might be some among some corners of American Christianity seeing the disaffiliation phenomenon over the last half century and wish casting that revival is happening. And there are some, momentous times in American history where there were, the Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening. So it's part of American history. So I think there might be some nostalgia too. Maybe we're looking at a Third Great Awakening. And the data is not bearing it out. But what we can say is we're seeing that plateau. We are seeing a slowing, which I think is interesting in its own right. But at this point, the non-affiliated population, the so-called nuns, not Catholic nuns, but N-O-N-E-S, the people that check the nun box on what religion are you on a survey, it's around a third of the U.S. population. It's like 29%, 30%. That's sizable. That's like one-third of this entire country is religiously unaffiliated. And that has plateaued, which is interesting. So maybe that means we're looking at the U-shaped graph coming back, or maybe that's a new baseline for religious affiliation. Something that makes me think that it's either going to continue to grow or perhaps stay at the baseline is that non-religion has proven to be pretty sticky across generations. And the sociologists I've read have actually used this term sticky, the stickiness of non-religion, insofar as it transmits to the next generation pretty easily. Where if let's use the UK as an example, because the studies I'm most familiar with are from the UK, where the numbers are quite shocking, that if you're a Christian family, you have like a 45% chance that your kid is going to disaffiliate. So 45% chance. So if you have, you know, two kids, there's a good chance one of them is going to disaffiliate. If you are a non-religious family and your kid, it's 95%. 95% your kid's going to be non-religious. So like the stickiness across generations is just off the charts. Like you'd have 100 kids, 95 of them are going to be non-religious. So at least in the UK context, it's those numbers are much lower in the US, but it is still, I think, 60%, something like that for non-religious stickiness across, you know, retention rates, if we can use that terminology, 60% retention rate for a non-religious kid growing up in a non-religious family would remain non-religious into the next generation. That just points to continued growth of non-religion in the next few decades, because you have the baseline of a non-religious family. There's a good chance that the kid is also going to be non-religious, which means that there's a good chance that that kid's kid is also going to be non-religious. So it transmits across generations more effectively or efficiently than religious identity.
I do like when academia kind of pounces on a pun. I think the rise of the nuns has been like the best, the kind of stickiest phrase to come out of kind of studies of religion in recent years.
And I'm surprised too, because haven't. It sounds like Catholic nuns. So when we're talking about religions, like, oh, nuns are growing, and they're like, oh, no, I don't mean nuns. So it's not best for a.
I know, and I'm surprised that there hasn't been a further pun to do with sticky nuns. That seems like ripe for some kind of, you know, when like papers have a humorous kind of 5-word catchphrase, and then a colon, and then what the paper's actually about. Yeah. I feel like the stickiness of nuns colon. Yeah. Something or other.
The paper I'm thinking about is titled like The Stickiness of Non-Religion, and then the subtitle says really what it says, and it's pretty recent study. It's like 2023, something like that. But yeah, and it's again focused on the UK context, but even in the US, the rates of the retention rates for non-religious families, you know, staying non-religious generation to generation, is higher than Christian families, even then, if we parse out different types of Christianities. So Catholicism, mainline Protestants are less sticky. Evangelical families are more sticky. So evangelicalism has proven to be very robust generation to generation in the US, which is interesting. We can get into that. There's a few sociological theories for why that might be. But I think when you look at the share of evangelicals in the US, that has grown. Whether that's, I don't know if that's size, you know, the actual size of the population, but the share of Christians in the U.S. are now, it's the evangelical share has grown.
That is really interesting. I would love to explore that more. What tends to make a particular religion or denomination of religion stickier than others across generations?
Well, the general rule of thumb, this is coming from the economist Lawrence Iannacone, and he published this article, I think, decades ago at this point, but the general thesis is that strict churches succeed. Stricter churches, you can also, he uses that word church, it's pretty Christian-centric. You could just say strict religions tend to succeed more than less strict religions. So religions that put more cost to membership, so abstaining from sex, abstaining from certain foods, certain type of dress, holding to more difficult to hold to beliefs like young earth creationism, religions with strict cost to membership filter out freeloaders. And the less freeloaders you have in your society, the more tightly bonded it is. So there's this phrase, costly signaling. They're costly signals to membership. And I think a very quintessential example would be the Amish. So I grew up in South Central Pennsylvania, right next to Amish County. So I'm at least would interact with Amish not infrequently. And it's very difficult to fake being a member of the Amish. When we talk about difficult to fake signals of membership, dressing in a certain way, not using electricity, making sure you're riding your horse and buggy instead of your car, there's a lot of costly signals to show that you are part of this this society. And lo and behold, the Amish have very high retention rates. They also have high fertility rates. So like the Amish population is growing very fast. It like doubled in the 90s and 2000s. Like it's growing very fast.
Wow.
Again, there's always going to be that slowing of the curve. Eventually, I don't think we're going to be like a...
Yes, you're just going to double generation on generation until the entire world is Amish.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we're looking at like a majority Amish world in the next 50 years, but it is growing very fast. And you see this in other high-cost membership religious groups like Hasidic Judaism as well, in Israel, and parts of the U.S. as well, where being part of the group means outward costly signals, ritual practice that is more costly, and that, again, bonds the group together, leads to higher retention rates. This is just one factor that's obviously going to be a multifactorial phenomenon, but this is one theory for why certain religious groups persist and others don't. And to bring it back to Christianity and evangelicalism, my hunch would be that mainline Protestantism tends to be more liberal in both its theology and its politics, but also in its costly signals, that you're more likely to be able to drink. Premarital sex might not be a socially ostracizing activity. So you can list a lot of things that are not where the so-called costly signals are not as costly compared to like a conservative evangelical church, where there are higher, harder to fake signs of your membership would result in higher retention rates.
That's interesting. That sort of makes me reflect on the Church of England, which is obviously our national church, which is, you know, very, very undemanding, and also sort of becomes less demanding over the years as they try and get people back in. And maybe they're on the wrong track and they should be much, much stricter if they want to retain their Anglican communion.
Yeah. And this, I mean, we can see this phenomenon across religions, not just Christianity. I mentioned Judaism briefly, but there's also extreme examples of like painful rituals. So there's a anthropologist, Dmitry Zigalitas, who studied like almost like self-mortification rituals in Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. And people would like stab themselves in the cheek with nails and needles during a particular religious festivals. This is like Tamil Hindu festivals, I think, for a Hindu god, Murugan or something. I think it's Murugan. And the people that are doing that, there's like this feedback loop between the audience and the person doing the painful ritual, where this is like a very costly signal showing their commitment to the group. And the people that are watching are like, wow, look at his commitment. So it kind of feeds back on their own sense of commitment to the group. So you can kind of see the sociological power of ritual, in particular extreme ritual and costly ritual. We can even think of martyrdom as like the ultimate extreme ritual, and how that plays into the sociological vigor of a particular community. If you have like the ultimate costly signal that this person really was committed to this community. There's also this term credibility enhancing display, credibility enhancing display, or cred, CRED. Like, creds has shown to be a very important factor in people staying in a group, because if you see the whole practice which you preach, if you see somebody that is part of your community, especially if they're a religious authority, not practicing what they preach, not putting credibility-enhancing displays into the sociological atmosphere, then you can see why somebody might disaffiliate. So there's all these theories about what causes people to disaffiliate, and credibility-enhancing displays, these costly signals that people put into society, have proven to be a very, if not the most important factor.
And that idea of a credibility-enhancing signal, it doesn't just apply to religions. It also applies to other types of in-group membership. I mean, I'm just thinking here about one of my friends went to university in America, and they joined this fraternity, And they just like tortured one another for about a month. And this seemed to very perversely bring them very, very close together. Is this just an aspect of a secular version of an in-group membership utilizing the same tools as a religious group?
My hunch is yes. I haven't studied those, and you know, I have not studied like a university fraternity to see, but we see similar social strategies in these so-called non-religious arenas. So whether it's initiation rituals or inauguration rituals to show which person is a leader in this particular community, these things span so-called religious and so-called secular spheres. So I think the general strategy, when thinking in the terms of ritual theory, what does a ritual do for a community? The general strategy of doing particular rituals to show your commitment to the group seems, you know, religiously agnostic. It's something that would be an effective social technology, whether it's a frat house or a church.
And just to bring it back very briefly to this idea of a Christian revival, we talked a little bit about the concept of media hype around this. And I do agree, you see headlines on this, at least in kind of my sphere of the internet, I suppose. You see headlines on this, kind of blog posts, articles about this coming out a lot. Do you have any idea of kind of what's behind that? You mentioned wishful thinking. Is this an example of anecdotes being sort of just blown out of proportion? Has this been a more kind of a focused kind of attempt to you know, will this into existence? What seems to be the kind of underlying motivation behind this seeming kind of attempt to wish a Christian revival into being the case?
This is just going to be pure speculation on my part. My hunch is it's just a purely social media phenomenon that, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many ways that things go viral on social media, and it's either, you know, outrage or sensationalism. And I can just, if I had to put a theory forward, my hunch is it's probably a small handful of Christian influencers who try to amplify a particular narrative, and that narrative gets picked up and shared. Everything I've seen of this is anecdotal. It's not data. Mm. It's not sociological data. In fact, the sociologists like Ryan Burge are like, no, this is not happening. So you can imagine how an anecdote could go viral on TikTok or YouTube or whatever, and then that feeds into the narrative. Because like I said earlier, if we saw the rates of reaffiliation necessary to even bring Gen Z back to a baseline of previous generations, just a baseline. We're not talking about, you know, a doubling and bringing that curve into a U-shape. It would just be unmistakable in society. Like every single church in the entire nation would just have this influx of people in order to get the sort of reaffiliation we would need to bring it back to baseline. Mm. So the fact that it seems to be spoken in like anecdotal stories and occasional headlines just makes me think it's a social media phenomenon, and maybe based on like a one particular church in one particular town saw its membership double from 40 to 80, and then they're like, wow, this is a revival. And then that gets picked up, even though the next city over, all the churches are still sitting at, you know, 30 members. So again, that's pure speculation on my part, but the fact that it's not based in data, the fact that the people who know the data say it's not happening, and that it seems to only be happening, that the narrative only seems to be happening on social media, makes me think it's a social media phenomenon.
Mm. And it is, social media is such an avenue for anecdotes to go viral. And so I'm taken in with this at times. You know, until I looked into it a bit more, I just kind of assumed that a Christian revival was going on because loads of people were talking about it. And I just kind of thought, oh, they've probably checked. And I think it was largely, you know, you have a sensational story of like an ex-atheist converting to Christianity. You know, in the UK, we had Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who was a staunch atheist for many years, and then had a kind of road to Damascus moment and became a Christian again. I feel like it's very easy for those sorts of anecdotes to then go completely viral because that's such a compelling story. Like if I was a believer, I would be shouting that from the rooftops as well. That's like an amazing story. It's like it's like the kind of, it's like having a deathbed conversion of Voltaire or something like that. You know, you if that were true, you'd be shouting it wherever you could.
Yeah, and Ayaan Hirsi Ali is an interesting case study too, because she was one of those initial horse women. She was the horse woman of the atheism apocalypse. Mm. But the other famous one were the horse men of Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett. But she was there publishing her book at the same time as they were publishing their book in the early 2000s. The whole new atheism thing was basically a publishing phenomenon, not a social media phenomenon, but a publishing phenomenon. And she was there with them. So that I can see how that would be such a major story. But then, Christopher Hitchens has now passed, but he remained atheist till the end. And Sam Harris is still out there being an atheist. So like, you have the one story yeah. that's masking over many people continuing to disaffiliate.
Yeah, you also do. I think I remember this with that interview that Richard Dawkins gave a few years ago, where he said he was a cultural Christian. And Richard Dawkins has always said that, by which he basically just means he grew up in a Christian country. And as a result is like steeped in a particular culture, which is like, you know, a perfectly innocuous thing to say, right? You know, I could say that, right? In the sense that obviously the UK has been like shaped by a Christian history. In that sense, almost everyone who was born in the UK and raised in the UK will be culturally Christian, but not much kind of... It's quite a minimal thing to say that then got kind of picked up and then blown out of proportion. Yeah. I am interested about atheism more generally, though, because I find these sorts of, I don't know if it's the right term, but atheistic religiosity very interesting. Things like people who would say, you know, I'm not religious, I don't believe in God, but I'm very spiritual. And, you know, they might express a belief in something like a universal balance. I personally meet a fair amount of people who say things like, I don't believe in God, but I believe that the universe will provide, or I believe that whatever I put into the universe, I will get out back at some later term. These kind of like quasi-religious beliefs, I would say. Is there, I know that you've looked into this a fair amount. What have you found?
So there are actually types of atheists. So atheism can be minimally defined as just a lack of belief in God or gods. But that's more of a minimal definition. And people are complicated and people are never consistent. So if you were to ask somebody on a survey, hey, do you believe in God? And they say no, you can check the atheism box. But they could be radically different than, say, a Sam Harris type atheist, who's the more stereotypical rationalistic and naturalistic empiricism type atheist. But the study of non-religion is growing pretty rapidly in my field of religious studies. Some of the top scholars in this field are actually at Queen's University Belfast, and there's a scholar, Jonathan Landman, who recently did a really big multi-year study of non-religion around the world, and he found, interestingly, with his colleagues, that around the world, the majority of atheists believe in at least one supernatural phenomenon.
Wow.
So that's pretty broad. That could be like belief in the afterlife, belief in karma or the soul or ghosts. You know, supernatural phenomenon is a very, very broad statement. So we shouldn't read too much into that. It's not like the majority of atheists also believe in spirits and the afterlife and God. You know, at a minimum, they don't believe in God or gods, but they also might believe in the universe gives back if I put something out there, the whole law of attraction that's so popular for manifesting practitioners. They might believe in karma or ghosts or the ancestors. And that's the majority of atheists. And even in the US, which it has pretty high rates of so-called the rationalistic atheists that are closer to the new atheist archetype, it's like 30%, a little bit over 30% are actually the naturalistic empiricist type atheists. The rest are believing at least some sort of supernatural phenomenon. So the scholars who study this have tried to categorize, because we religion scholars love to categorize, but they try to categorize the different types of atheists. And one of these categories are what they call spiritual atheists. Spiritual atheists, they might believe in some supernatural phenomenon. They might engage in some sort of practices like meditation or manifesting. And as what gets them to be called atheists is just because they say they don't believe in God. So they fit the minimal definition, but they still are spiritual, however they define spiritual. That is its own can of worms. We're spiritual but not religious. I would just say spiritual is religion. it's in some sense, it's a non-traditional religion, and insofar it's not rooted in a particular tradition, a particular ism like Buddhism or Hinduism. You could say it's eclectic, where they can piece together their own type of ritual practices. They might do Hindu-inspired yoga on one side, and mid-20th century self-help manifestation on the other side. Mm-hmm. So this is eclectic, and it's individual. It's individualistic. It's not rooted in a particular community of practice, but it's still religion. It's still ritual. It still might involve spirits and belief in the supernatural phenomenon. So in my mind, spiritual but not religious is an interesting term that people use to describe themselves. And me as the scholar looks at it and redescribes it as a form of religion that is individualized, eclectic, non-communal, and sometimes implies a antagonistic stance toward those more communal, traditional-based religions where, I'm not religious. Well, what do you mean by religious? You mean maybe dogmatic? Maybe you mean oppressive? Like, there's a lot of value judgment, I think, hidden behind the scenes of that phrase, spiritual but not religious.
I know anecdotally, for what it's worth, whenever I meet someone like this, they do often express a skepticism, particularly for organized religion, mm-hmm. And often they will point to a particular events that have disabused them of not necessarily the truth of a particular proposition of organized religion. How we might, we have a picture of in the kind of online agnostic stroke atheist sphere of, how somebody loses their faith as they sit down and they read this a book by Graham Oppie, and they become convinced of methodological naturalism, and as a result they see that there might not be a need to propose a supernatural objects or subjects to explain things, and as a result they very calmly and reasonably conclude that they're going to now be an agnostic or a naturalist as opposed to religious. That, as far as I can tell, is like just not how it happens, and in the vast majority of cases there seems to be a much more complex story going on here. And I know you've talked about we were talking earlier about creds. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the right term for it. Almost seems like there's a kind of decreds. Mm-hmm. That disabuses people of religion in the same way that a cred can strengthen their religious faith.
Well, atheism via rationalism, like you just described, is actually quite rare, where, somebody picked up, David Hume or something, and then they rationalize their way out of theism. That happens, obviously happens, we hear anecdotally it happens, but when you look at the population level, it's actually quite a rare way to find your way out of theism into atheism. So there's another scholar, Will Gervais, who recently published a book called Disbelief, I believe, Disbelief in a Religious Species or something like that. Will Gervais, amazing scholar. And he identified several pathways to atheism. And rationalism is one of the pathways that people do. So, reason their way out of religion. And I'm using these words somewhat loosely. I'm not saying that it's unreasonable to be religious, but people who like think rationally, like, oh, okay, I don't believe this, therefore I'm going to be atheist. That sort of self-reflective pathway to atheism is quite rare, and it's not a cross-cultural phenomenon. There was a study done a few years ago that looked at like 12 different nations, really religiously diverse, China, UAE, the UK, the United States, and there were only 3 countries in the entire study. I think it was Australia, Singapore, and the U.S., where the rational, self-reflective pathway to atheism had any sort of popularity. More often, it was credibility-enhancing displays. People not seeing credible adherence to the religious dogmas and practices that people say they should follow, and therefore them deciding to leave because of that. And I think that makes a lot of sense because we're not really a rational species, but we are a social species. and when we see our fellow social members not doing what we are told they should be doing, that decreases credibility and increases your chances of leaving. The other two pathways to atheism he pointed out, one is called mentalizing. So this is the whole concept of theory of mind. Our theory of mind is our ability to recognize intentions and mental states of others. So I can sit here trying to mentalize what you're thinking. Are you interested in this conversation? Are you getting bored? Should I talk about something else? So that's my theory of mind, trying to intuit your internal mental state. Babies and toddlers don't have this. They can't mentalize what other people are thinking. Mm. So they're surprised if somebody doesn't know what they know. But as you grow up, you start to develop your theory of mind. Will Gervais argued that people who have a harder time mentalizing have a harder time believing in gods, because you need to be able to mentalize the mental state of what Jesus wants of you. So there's this famous statement from the 90s, what would Jesus do? And that's a theory of mind statement. What would Jesus do? You have to sit there and mentalize, what would Jesus want me to do here? It's all a theory of mind activity. And he argued, and he did a study, I think, with Noren Zion. He published his book, Big Gods. He's pretty famous in that field. That had some early suggestive data that there seems to be a connection between lower rates of mentalization and higher rates of atheism. It was not replicated in further studies. So this is pretty, it's not fully accepted at this point in the field. It's possible, not really a strong pathway to atheism. The other pathway, Will Gervais argued, was what we were kind of getting at earlier about war, instability, something about the creature comforts means you have less concerns, and therefore you don't fall back on things that have been proven to actually help with higher rates lower rates of depression, higher rates of mental health, which is like religious ritual and being part of a religious community, which is pretty interesting because a lot of people who view some of the more antagonistic people to religion will be like, oh, religion is oppressive and I have religious trauma, which is very true for a lot of people. But when you look at the population level, being part of a religious community actually increases your psychological sense of well-being. And you can think about being accepted by other people, having a place in the world and having a place in the universe. You can see how that could feed into a sense of well-being. And so the argument is in societies where there are less existential risks. So the example always used are the Nordic countries like Norway, Iceland, where there's just very high rates of secularity, where you have very large social safety nets, that would play into lower rates of religiosity. Again, so Will Gervais uses the term apatheism, which I think is a very interesting term. Apatheism, you're less, oh, yeah, less you have this apathy toward religion because it's not doing much for you.
That really rings true in a sense. Again, just anecdotally in the UK, because there is oftentimes, if we're a relatively non-religious country. I don't know if we're quite as non-religious as the Scandinavian countries, but certainly we're pretty up there. And a lot of the time, I'm really interested in philosophy of religion, right? So I quite often end up playing the theist in discussions down the pub with my not remotely interested in philosophy of religion friends, and quite often, it won't be that they have a kind of particular religious trauma, or won't be that they have like extreme arguments against religion. It's just that it just doesn't occur to them. Like there's just no, they were raised in a non-religious household, which, as we pointed out, is quite a sticky belief system. And then also they just think, well, why would I? Like, what's the point? Like, what's it doing? Which I find absolutely fascinating because I can so see that perspective on things. Like, it just never comes up.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's, so that same stickiness in non-religion study, that those same sociologists studied British kids raised in non-religious families, and their conclusion was that these kids were being socialized into a worldview, but the worldview was broadly humanistic. And you can use that word humanism pretty broadly, but it is a worldview. It's not like the kids are completely amoral, lacking any sense of right and wrong. Like they're acculturated into a humanism where humans are the primary agent in the world. Science is the main way you find out about the world. And religion is viewed as something that's particular and cultural, and maybe even something familial. So that's what your family does. That's what your culture does. But that's not this universal humanism that I've been taught as a kid. So that's part of how the stickiness and non-religion perpetuates, is these kids have a worldview that they're drawn to. And they use this, the sociologists use these two terms, push factors and pull factors, away from religion. So push factors would be like you had religious trauma, you are very angry that you were raised with young earth creationism, then you were suddenly taught that evolution is a thing, you believe in LGBTQ equal rights, and you're angry that your religious community thinks that they don't, LGBTQ people shouldn't marry. So these are push factors. But then there's a pull factor towards something like humanism where you find it very attractive. And there's all sorts of pull factors we can get into. And when they study these families, there's not much animosity toward religion. It's fairly apathetic, or viewing it as something, again, particular. So I think it's a little bit of it's a stereotype, the whole angry atheist stereotype that all these non-religious people are angry toward religion. It's actually usually apatheism of some sort. to bring it full circle, the whole argument that lower existential risks means more non-religion might be tied to credibility enhancing displays, where if you are not if your society is not engaging in much religion, then that just feeds back into there's not a lot of credibility enhancing displays going into society that would make you more religious. So it's hard to say if this pathway is like a cause or if it's just tied to credibility enhancing displays. And this, it might also be tied to like religious pluralism. If you're in a pluralistic society where you have a lot of different contending creds from a lot of different religious communities, it kind of muddles the signal to noise ratio, where you will be in a society with a lot of different religions and there's not like the driving sociological force of one particular religion that everybody shares, and that's a credibility enhancing display. It's more like, okay, that's particular for you but not for me, and that again leads to higher rates of disaffiliation.
It's interesting that, of course, today, even if you are religious and even if you aren't devoutly religious, you still have to conceive of your religion as one option among many. In a way that seems like, at the very least, it wouldn't be the case 600 years ago. Let's place it pre-Reformation so that we avoid that particular controversy. And I think this ties into something that you've talked a lot about, which is that when we imagine what it's like to be, you know, a religious medieval peasant or something, we often end up transplanting a lot of our kind of modern assumptions about religion that aren't even necessarily ones that we're aware of. They just bubble underneath the surface. We can't think of a way of conceiving of things like religion or magic or rituals in the same way that someone would as a kind of 13th century medieval peasant who's active in their church community. It'd be really interesting just to outline some of the differences between our current way of just even conceiving of religion that stretches across both atheists and theists, and the way that someone would have conceived of their particular religion, say, you know, medieval France or somewhere like that.
Well, so much of what, at least in the US and most of Europe, so much of what we think of religion is shaped by Protestant Christianity. The whole enterprise of the academic study of religion that grew out of the 1800s and early 1900s was spearheaded by Protestant Christians. And the joke is that religion is anything that sufficiently looks like Protestant Christianity. If it has a sacred text, it has belief in a supernatural being called God, it has religious authorities called pastors or theologians or priests, and if it looks sufficiently like Protestant Christianity, we're going to call it religion. And this grew out, again, in the 1800s and early 1900s, and you had these attempts to categorize types of religion into universal religions and what they called cultural or particular or, you know, ethnic religions. So Christianity and Buddhism were kind of viewed as these the pinnacle of universalizing religions, and they would make Buddhism look like Protestant Christianity with a founder and sacred texts called the Pali Canon and religious leaders called monks. And then they had more what they would call ethnic religions like Hinduism and Judaism. Again, so much of this is just wrapped up in European colonialism and imperialism, trying to parcel out the world into these different types of groups. And you know, as the decades go on, you start to realize, like, not, you know, Protestant Christianity is not the essential religion. You have so many religions that are not as focused on belief, for example. A lot of people would think of religion as primarily a belief system. But a lot of religions, you know, are not as focused on beliefs. It's more focused on practice. Correct practice, what you do. Some of it might be tied toward relationships with particular spirits or particular natural features, which is sometimes called animism, which itself has its own tortured history. But the more modern understanding of animism is a worldview that's more relational with nature and non-human persons, whether we think of those as animals or spirits or natural features. And so your initial question was about somebody in antiquity to today. You know, the word religion, when you think about the history of the word religion, it has a history. And if you went back to medieval France and said, hey, are you religious? They would be like, well, no, because religious meant a Catholic monk. So these terms secular and religious come from the terms, I think it's secularis and religioso or something like that. I need to brush up on my Latin. But it was basically the monks were the religious clergy, and then you had the priests that were not monastic. They were the secular, secularis. And so we get those two terms, but it's kind of silly to say that one is secular and one is religious. We would both call them religious today because they're both clergy or, you know, religious functionaries in this religion that we call Catholicism. So the term itself throughout the 1800s and 1900s came to mean something. And for us, it meant like belief in supernatural, religious functionaries like priests and pastors, sacred texts, founders like the Buddha and Jesus. But most people throughout history were not thinking in sort of secular versus religious. You would go back to ancient Greece, ancient Rome. The religious and the secular were suffused. There was no secular sphere and religious sphere. A temple, so we can think of the famous Temple of Artemis outside of Ephesus, which, you know, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It also functioned as a bank. Like people held money there.
Wow, I didn't know that.
You would look at ancient Babylonian and Sumerian texts, clay tablets, and you have these priests, you know, holding livestock and putting out lines of credit. Like when we think of the banking world, the financial world, and the religious world, you know, there was no distinction in antiquity. So the whole, you know, is this religious? You know, that's a very modern question that I think for most of human history, most humans would have been confused by.
I find that fascinating. I've been reading viewers of the channel, and I've been reading a lot of Charles Taylor's A Secular Age recently, and it similarly talks about the idea that, you know, this division between the religious and the secular as we understand it, as opposed to how a medieval speaker would understand it, is just like is inconceivable. Like they wouldn't have the conceptual scheme to totally understand it. I really interesting what you say about Buddhism. I got really into Buddhist epistemology and logic at university, which is really fun. I highly encourage people to check it out, because it's a really interesting topic. But I've often found that in our, you know, on the kind of English speaking online sphere, we often really try to cram Buddhism into a form of almost Christianity, like as in into a form of, like, is it, we ask questions like, is it monotheistic, is it polytheistic, is it atheistic, is it agnostic? And it does seem like these are all kind of attempts to impose a kind of artificial category from the outside that doesn't quite make sense within,
well, trying to fit it,
most
trying,
yeah,
trying to fit it, sorry, into a in, into a Protestant shaped box, like, oh, the,
yeah, exactly,
so
you're saying, like, trying to be like,
or, yeah.
Yes, and, you know, saying, well, we've got the Tripitaka and we've got the Buddha and you know, and also even referring to Siddhartha Gautama as the Buddha, you know, as opposed to a Buddha, is seems to be like a kind of an outside imposition. I know that you've spoken a fair amount about this in the past. What would you say to someone like, you know, many of my audience who are predominantly from English-speaking countries, but, you know, might have an interest in Buddhism or forms of Hinduism, but are likely, when looking at these religions, to carry a kind of Protestant boxing exercise inherently with them without even necessarily realizing it? How would we go about avoiding that?
Yeah. The overwhelming focus on belief is one of the first things I would say. Like, Protestant Christianity, and Christianity in general, but Protestants in particular, have this very strong focus on the cognitive assent to certain truth claims. Like, you need to believe that Jesus Christ is Savior to have salvation. And that overwhelming focus on what we could call a creedal statement, the Nicene Creed being, you know, recited by literally hundreds of millions of Christians around the world every single week. It's a creedal religion, and that's interesting, and that should be filed away as an interesting thing. But when you go to Buddhism, there's not necessarily that overwhelming focus on belief. Of course, all religions involve some level of belief, but it's not the primary overarching focus. You know, you can think of many forms of Buddhism where the focus would be on, you know, merit-making practices to build up karma. I'm not a scholar of Buddhism, so I'm a little bit outside my wheelhouse here. So that would be one thing to focus on. The other thing to think about is we tend to essentialize religion. So trying to boil down what are the like essential features of this particular tradition. And I mentioned a while ago that religion, the people are not consistent. People are very inconsistent. And nothing tends to fit into a very essentialized box. So when we think of something like Buddhism, we might focus on the Lotus Sutra or meditation and things that we would consider quintessentially Buddhist might play a minor role in your average Buddhist's daily life. Meditation is the primary example where I think the overwhelming majority of Western Buddhists meditate. Like that is a major part of the practice, and that's, I'm not going to knock that. That's great and interesting for them. But for most of Buddhist history, it was a monastic practice. It was an elite practice done by the smallest percentage of practicing Buddhists. So this is an interesting modern phenomenon. But for most of Buddhists, and I would say most Buddhists outside of the Western context, you know, they're not meditating. So this thing that we think of as quintessentially Buddhist, that's not what they're doing. You can think of Taoism as another example. I have quite a few videos on Taoism where we think of like the Tao Te Ching as this quintessentially Taoist thing. It's the Taoist text, and most Taoists aren't reading it. In fact, most Taoists don't call themselves Taoist. You know, if you go ask people that go to Taoist temples in China, the word Taoist is reserved for like a priest or some sort of religious functionary. You're not going to call yourself a Taoist, but you might go to a Taoist temple and sit in on a Taoist liturgy. But you're not necessarily reading the Taoist canon, which is, you know, 1,500 texts that barely anybody is reading. So there, when we think in terms of Protestant-shaped religions, things don't look like Protestant Christianity. Protestant Christianity looks like Protestant Christianity, and even though we might call something the Taoist canon, the canon is functioning in Taoism very differently than how it functions as in the Christian canon. So the logics of different features of different religions are not always easily compared on a one-to-one basis. We can call both of these things canon, but the canon in Christianity is this very important overarching thing, and the Taoist canon is like this wibbly wobbly flexible thing that has evolved and been destroyed and recreated several times over the centuries, and that almost nobody reads. So these terms, I think, should be held somewhat loosely in our minds when we're trying to do cross-cultural comparative religion.
No, that's brilliant. I it's interesting the example of meditation, because I do sometimes think that the Western world's fascination with meditation, specifically in Buddhism, is a little bit like if suddenly millions of people across China or India all got really into psalm chanting. And like nothing else about just like psalm chanting became huge, and there were you know Chinese influencers saying you've got there's this thing psalm chanting, this is like it's going to change your life. Like I'd imagine it must look just as bizarre sort of the other way around.
Yeah, and specifically chanting psalms in like Greek or Latin or you know something.
Yeah, exactly. It's incredibly esoteric practice, or just this kind of that something practiced by a very very small number of believers, largely sequestered in monasteries. Yeah, I think that's really really interesting.
Especially I'm not when it saying comes it's to like an illegitimate form of Buddhism. I'm just saying it's a type of Buddhism that emerged through the contingent historical processes over the course of probably the last 100 or 200 years. The history of modern Buddhism and its travel over to the Europe and the U.S. is very interesting. But at least in the U.S. context, meditation is one practice that really took off. And for most of Buddhist history, just was not primary to your average lay Buddhist.
Yes, yeah. No, and I find that just kind of thing fascinating, the way that different aspects of religion get translated or fall away when transplanted into a totally different cultural context. I know also that the practice of communal ritual is much more prominent in, say, Nepal than it is amongst kind of practicing Buddhists in the West.
Yeah. And you see battles over categories too, where people are like, oh, Buddhism's not a religion, it's a philosophy. And I think that's also interesting because it shows what people think religion counts as and what philosophy counts as. A lot of these more, some of these European scholars back in the early 1900s were trying to parse between what they viewed as universal Buddhism and like ethnic Buddhism. Like, oh, that more particular ethnic Buddhism, that's what those people are doing at the temples and their merit-making practices. That's not real, true, essential Buddhism. Mm. Essential Buddhism is what the Buddha taught, these particular texts. And they were trying to parse between what they viewed as like this unvarnished philosophy and what they viewed as these cultural admixtures that messed with the pure philosophy of the Buddha, which I think is this, again, an artificial bifurcation. You could try to do the same exercise with Christianity, where like, oh, the true Christian message are like the red letters of the Gospels when Jesus was speaking, and oh, that Christian rock that those evangelicals are doing, that's cultural admixture. And I don't know, it just sounds weird when you put it into that context. Like, oh, these are just forms of Christianity that are these complex systems that change over time and mix and match different cultural elements and go in unexpected ways.
Yes, the sort of only unfamiliarity that makes it seem like we can draw this very, very sharp distinction. That again, we wouldn't. I'm going to say put up with this, which isn't quite the right word, but I'll say it anyway. Like, we wouldn't put up with this when examining our own culture. We recognize that, you know, an evangelical isn't a sort of, I mean, well, at least I would not recognize an evangelical as a sort of inferior, corrupted form of Christianity, and that actually, you know, the only form of Christianity is found in the Gospels and nowhere else, not even in the Old Testament. You know, I think that's technically a heresy now, or has been a heresy for hundreds of years. I mean, it's interesting you bring up the aspect of the label of whether something is religious or not. You know, this kind of, because it's become almost fashionable, I suppose, to pick things out in the public domain and say this is quintessentially religious. You know, I mean, the classic thing is that, you know, for a while there were loads of think pieces being like woke is religious, or Trumpism is religious, or yeah. Veganism is religious, or Swifties are religious. That's the most recent one, because there was the Eras tour, and so she was everywhere. Yeah. She came to the city I lived in, and it was like impossible to walk anywhere that day. And you know, we've got into the habit of labeling these things as religions, or using that as a kind of rhetorical strategy. What's lost, I suppose, firstly, when we kind of pick up the religion label and start kind of stamping it on various different things? It feels like it's often an attempt to use quite negative connotations that someone might associate with religion and then kind of stamp it on something else. But also, it does seem like there are genuine similarities between the practices of say, fan culture or a political movement and what we might call traditional organized religion. How do we get the balance right between not going too far in the direction of saying, oh, these are exactly the same as religions and we don't need to say much more about it, and not recognizing the both religions and secular forms of, you know, collective effervescence, to use the Durkheim term, do share genuine similarities and crossover that is interesting.
So, yeah, first of all, we should recognize that so many of these comparisons are polemics. You know, wokeism is a religion, Trumpism is a religion. These are used as polemical, rhetorical devices. Ironically, sometimes, like, I've seen this done by, like, Answers in Genesis, the Young Earth Creationist organization in the U.S., where they'll be like, evolutionism is a religion, and I'm like, well, you're a religious organization, so are you using religion here as an insult? So first and foremost, it's a polemic. But you're right that I think people are seeing something that is real, but we need to parse that out more carefully, because so religion, I would say, is a collection of human behaviors that are not uniquely religious. Religion is not some special, unique corner of culture that is untouched by other parts of culture. What we call a religion, like Christianity or Buddhism, is a collection of very human things that humans like to do. So humans like hierarchies. They seem to organize their institutions into hierarchical structures. We could call those presidents and prime ministers and congresspeople, or we can call them priests and monks and deacons. Okay, so hierarchies, that's the thing. Humans also like to gather together in groups and sing and chant and dance And we can sometimes call that a rave or a concert, or we can call that an evangelical church service on a Sunday morning with a praise band. Humans like, so to go back to an example like mentalizing, you know, they like to attribute personhood and agency to things that we might call non-human. So we could attribute personhood and agency to a mountain or a spirit or a entity that we call God or Jesus. So we can say religion is, I like the phrase, a biocultural phenomenon. There's biological bases to religion. So what I was just mentioning with mentalizing, there seems to be a tie between the origin of belief in invisible beings and our ability to mentalize and to see agency and personhood everywhere. And it's also a cultural phenomenon. Writing and church authorities and mythologies told from generation to generation, this is all cultural production. So then we start seeing these very human things in other arenas that we would call non-religious. So then we start asking questions, is a Philadelphia Eagles football game, is that a religious gathering? And I think that's the wrong question, because it continues to keep the specialness of religion. So let's stop saying religion is special. And I'm not trying to be insulting here. I'm trying to say, let's not give special privilege to religion as a cultural human phenomenon. Let's instead ask, is the evangelical church service the game day of Christianity? Instead of asking the game day, is that religious? Let's try to flip the question on its head. Is a church service a game day? You know, it happens once a week. People gather, they cheer. It's a game day. It sounds kind of silly, but my point is trying to invert, why are we privileging religion? When we say, is the Eras tour for Taylor Swift, was that a religious gathering? We can instead say, when a famous pastor goes from, let's say like William Lane Craig or something like that, a famous pastor goes from church to church and people gather and they excitedly listen to him, let's just call that a tour or a concert tour. You know, we shouldn't privilege religion. Religion, in many respects, is an empty bucket in which we can throw whatever we want into it. We usually throw texts that we call sacred. We usually throw mythologies and gods and things that we think of stereotypically religious into that bucket. But in many respects, that's kind of an artificial demarcation that we drew around these particular human behaviors and called them religious. And then we drew lines around these other things and we called those government. But those are us. That's us, the students and scholars of religion, drawing those lines. Those lines between the secular and the religious, they don't exist naturally in the same way that the line between Canada and the U.S. doesn't exist naturally. It exists, and that I would be arrested if I try to sneak into Canada, but it's artificial and socially constructed. So it's us saying that, putting our hand over the heart and saying the Pledge of Allegiance to the U.S. flag, oh, that's secular. But when we chant the Nicene Creed, that's religious. That's me making that distinction. But it's the same thing. It's a communal ritual, a credibility-enhancing display that I belong to this community, and I show some fealty to this symbol, the American flag, or to Jesus Christ. And it's doing similar work. It's doing similar work in society. So a lot of scholars, at least in my camp, we've kind of tried to stop defining religion. Not that religion can't be defined, it just can be defined 50 different ways, and a lot of those ways are worse than others. We try to instead focus on the function of a particular practice or belief. What is that doing in society? And once you start focusing on function, you then start seeing religion everywhere, because humans are deploying similar technologies in different arenas. Gathering together, chanting and singing together, and wearing particular t-shirts that might say Taylor Swift on them, that is doing some sort of social bonding phenomenon in that community right there. It's creating a group identity. It's creating this collective effervescence, as Emile Durkheim would say, like this social electricity running through the crowd. So the ritual is doing something. And that ritual, that social technology works, whether if the object of study, the object of focus is a flag, a national flag, or a religious entity like God or Jesus. And that's why I think so many people are like, oh, is this religious or is this religious? They're noticing something, but they're not able to articulate it, which is that humans do human things. And sometimes we draw lines around those things and say, oh, this is religion and this is civic ritual. But I would say, well, these are all these are all functioning in similar ways. And sometimes it's focused on the supernatural. And sometimes it's focusing on something that's been elevated to a sacred status, like the American flag or the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. We could talk about American civil religion, but it's religious in as much as what we might call stereotypical religion, like Christianity.
It's fascinating from a UK perspective as well, because especially growing up, I remember a teacher telling me about I don't know if this still happens, but the idea of all of the kids in an American school at the beginning of the day saying the Pledge of Allegiance. Which struck our totally unused to it UK school children ears as like a religious ritual, but in fact, you know, it's they're both partaking of the same baseline biocultural. I like that as a term. That's lovely. Yeah. Stuff.
Well, because so much of religion is rooted in our biology, and we could take this even further and say that animals are religious too, and that. Mm-hmm. Religion, that it's not a uniquely human thing, and that it's just in a spectrum of animal behavior. You know, obviously, an elephant's not going to be reading the Lotus Sutra, but an elephant does seem to have some level of recognition and respect for a dead compatriot, where they linger over mm-hmm. a dead elephant and touch it, and there's some level of grief. So if we can say that, if we can try to pare back our definition of religion to be not human-centric, that doesn't require anything human, like language, maybe we can find this kernel of religion. People use terms like proto-religion or quasi-religion. I, again, think that's people trying to protect religion as something special. let's just call it religion, where it seems to be based in like emotions and feelings. And that might be some where religion would be on a spectrum of animal behavior.
And to almost circle back to the idea of spiritual atheism and things like that, in terms of how a spiritual atheist gets created, I suppose, for want of a better term, is it normally that someone grows up non-religious, or just kind of the baseline is non-religion for them, and then they will find something like, you know, because of those impulses that we share, you know, not only with one another, but also with animals, will find a kind of thing to fill the gap that religion would have filled for them? Or is it normally that they have come from a particular religious background and they lose faith in that particular religious background, but still maintain some kind of idea of providential order to the universe or something like that?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. So the studies on childhood psychology show that kids need culture to become religious in the ways that we're thinking here, where they believe in a particular God. How do they interact with that God? You know, all of that comes from culture. But scholars of childhood psychology have identified certain, we can call them like cognitive biases, you know, hardwired into the human brain, that make theistic ideas intuitive. So the scholar I'm thinking of here is Justin Barrett. He published a book called Born Believers, I believe. And one of them goes back to the theory of mind thing I was talking about. There's something called the Hyperactive Agency Detection Device, HADD or HAD. It's such a ridiculous term. I don't know why they call it that. But hyperactive agency, why is it a device? I'm not a cognitive science, so they might have a good answer to that. Hyperactive agency detection is something that you've probably felt yourself, where you like woke up in the middle of the night and you thought you saw some being in the corner. And you're like, oh, fuck. But it's like your coat hanger or whatever.
Yeah.
The argument is that over eons of human evolution, we have evolved this hyperactive agency detection because it is better safe than sorry. It's better to be, oh, man, that must be a bear, but it's just a boulder, than to be like, oh, that's just a boulder, and it's a bear and it jumps on you and eats you. Like, it's better safe than sorry. And that this better safe than sorry cognitive bias has led to us seeing agency and intentionality everywhere. So you hear a noise behind you, you're like, oh, some sort of agent must have made that noise, even though it's just the wind. So this is one of those why I call it biocultural. It might be one of the biological bases predisposes people to theism. But that alone isn't going to lead somebody to become a Christian or a Hindu or whatever. That is where culture comes in. And to go back to theory of mind, another study found that kids and adults have different ideas of God until the kid's theory of mind starts to develop, and they're able to intuit what their parents want them to believe about God, and then the kids and the parents start to link up more on what they think God is.
So, what did the kids begin thinking that God is?
Well, so this was again the U.S. context, so I'm not sure if this is a cross-cultural phenomenon, but at least in the U.S. context where they studied this, and they were studying mostly monotheistic religions, so I think it was Christian families, Muslim families, and Jewish families, young kids were more likely to anthropomorphize God, to believe God had a body, God had hands. And again, there are many religions out there. I believe Mormonism believes in a more corporeal God. So in this case, though, they were like, the parents generally were not anthropomorphizing God. But as the kids got older, they started to anthropomorphize less, and they linked up more with their parents' non-anthropomorphic view of God. And they made the theory that it was based on theory of mind, because we would expect if the kids were just mimicking, just learning to imitate the parents, it would link up closer even at a young age. But the fact that it was so different at a young age shows that they were not yet intuiting what the parents believe. So our ideas of God seem to be tied to biological cognitive processes, but we need culture to be acculturated into a particular tradition. So this brings us back to non-religion, where non-religious unaffiliation continues to be passed forward generation to generation because there's no credibility-enhancing displays, there's no acculturation, but we still see high rates of belief in the supernatural. We see high rates of ritual, whether we can call it manifestation or meditation. And I think that goes back to stuff we've been talking about here, where these practices and these beliefs have functions outside of particular religious communities and religious traditions, where you can imagine what a ritual like manifestation does for someone psychologically. Maybe it has something to do socially, even though it's an individual practice. You can have some sort of identity online interacting with other manifestors. So the ritual is still doing something psychologically. It's still doing something sociologically. So it still has a role to play, even in a so-called disenchanted world, I think that's Charles Taylor's term.
Yes, yeah.
Where we could live in a so-called disenchanted world. I don't think we do, but I think this would explain why we see such high rates of spiritual atheists, so to speak, where these practices are still playing a role. We're still humanly, biologically predisposed to certain ideas that seem intuitive to the human mind, and I don't think that's going to go away. So to bring it back full circle, when we talk about that plateau of the ski slope, I don't know how much lower it can go, because humans, I do think, gravitate toward ritual. We gravitate towards certain ideas that seem intuitive, like belief in invisible agency, whether we call that invisible agent the universe or angels or spirits. And so it's hard for me to envision that disappearing entirely unless there's like a categorical sea change in how the human mind works.
Yeah. It's interesting, this idea of spiritual atheism or atheists coming to have some kind of religious belief. Because I remember years and years ago, there was the, I think, quite short-lived phenomenon of atheist churches. And you will know more about this than I will. So maybe it wasn't short-lived at all. Maybe that's just, I'm kind of making a mistake there. But I remember that not quite catching on in quite the same way that one might expect it to, right? You've got this kind of group of people all, at least on the face of it, rallying round a shared belief about the nature of the universe and building a community around that fact. It could be that I'm totally wrong and atheist churches are a much bigger thing than I think they are. But at the very least, it seems like that didn't take off. And actually, the more dominant forms of religious belief among atheists do fall into these more loosely spiritual camp. Is it that these spiritual beliefs have something to them in terms of cognitive content that the atheist churches didn't? Because, you know, thinking about our discussion where we think about, you know, among the things that bring people to religion are things like gathering in a single space and having rituals. And it seems like the atheist churches had all of that kind of going for them. But it didn't seem to quite succeed, at least if I'm right about that. And whereas these other forms of belief seem to have caught on in a much more major way. Do you have any idea why that might be?
I think your hunch is correct. I don't think atheist churches are particularly popular. It strikes me as a very niche type of society. My hunch would be back to the costly signals that we were talking about. Like what maybe if the church, the atheist church, said you must wear this particular type of T-shirt all the time, and you have to abstain from eating bacon and premarital sex. Like these are social technologies that help with social bonding. So lacking basically any and all, I'm assuming that these are liberal leaning. Pluralistic groups that have no costly signals. You know, come as you are and hang out and sing a few songs and have some meal. Like, so there might be some social benefit to the weekly interaction, and there's probably some nostalgia from ex-Christians who want that sort of Sunday morning gathering. But without the costly signals, there's I can imagine there's less of those invisible social binding agents that keep a community together. That's just a hunch, but I think you do see interesting examples maybe in contemporary paganism, where you have a lot of contemporary pagans like Wiccans, Druids, who you have a mix of both individual practitioners, and then you have like coven-based Wiccans who do have gatherings. And I'd be curious to see where, like, do we see some sort of vitality in the coven-based groups where there are some level of, especially ones that are more initiatory, like you're initiated into a group, there are rituals binding you together. That would be an interesting case study as well. Again, outside my wheelhouse, but my hunch is you need these social technologies that humans have developed to have a group succeed. And as Yannacone said decades ago, it's the strict churches that seem to succeed, at least on a larger time scale. But again, we're seeing that ski slope. So like those costly signals and credibility enhancing displays might lend some durability to a group generation to after generation, but we still see attrition. But there's another study that just came to mind by, I think his name is Richard Sosis. He studied, agricultural communes in Israel called kibbutz, comparing secular kibbutz with religious ones. And the religious ones lasted longer. The secular ones dissolved faster over the years. And it's something about the religious rituals as a binding agent to keep these groups more durable over generations.
And do we see any kind of costly signaling within these sort of atheist spiritualist movements? Sort of, or does it not needed as much because it's much more of an individual thing?
I don't know these groups well enough. I visited one for a project, one of the videos I published a few years ago called Houston Oasis. I don't even know if it's around still. And it appeared to be kind of similar to an evangelical gathering. There were songs and there was like a sermon, to use that word loosely. But it struck me as, again, very pluralistic. Join if you want, join if you don't. Like there's little expectation where you're showing your commitment to the group. I think Yannacone uses this term hard to fake, and which it's hard to fake practices. And when you think of hard to fake practices, it's usually clothing, it's behavior, it's food. There's nothing of the sort. I can't even imagine an atheist church where it's like, you can't eat this particular food, or you have to stay away from caffeine, or you have to stay from alcohol, or you can't eat shellfish. Like there's a lot of food practices around religions around the world. You know, Judaism comes to mind, Mormonism comes to mind, and like it's a hard to fake practice, because if you're caught out in the world, you know, drinking your alcohol when you're not supposed to, like it's a credibility decreasing display. And I think the very very messaging of these atheist churches is the opposite of that.
I mean, it's funny you talk about food rituals. I've always wanted to ask a scholar of religion this, because I've found it fascinating, but I've never really looked into it. Why pigs? Like, what is it about pigs that so many religions that emerge from a particular section of the world find, like, have structured kind of their food-based sacrifices, not sacrifices in the sense of sacrificing animals, you know, food-based costly displays around. Is that a contingent historical thing? Is it something to do with the pigs that were around at the time? Is it that they've all inherited it from a kind of original anti-pig food ritual?
Man, so I published a video on why pigs. I have to dig deep back into my memory, but there's an archaeologist, I think his name is Max Price, who published a book on pigs in the ancient Levant, explaining where the pig taboo, the pork taboo, came from in ancient Israelite society. It does predate the ancient Israelites, and it seems to have formed sometime in the Bronze Age, because if you look back at the copper, the Chalcolithic Age, way back then, that people were still eating pigs. Sometime in the late Bronze Age, not late Bronze Age, throughout the Bronze Age, it seems to have decreased. And by the time you get to the ancient Israelite kingdoms, it's becoming more of a taboo. But even then, it's not completely universal. Like, there was a fully articulated pig skeleton discovered in Iron Age levels of Jerusalem just a few years ago. So there were people owning pigs in downtown Jerusalem around the fall of Jerusalem in the 500s BCE. So it really crystallized in like the Hellenistic era, where you have this clash of Greek culture with Jewish culture. You had the Maccabean revolt, really, really crystallized as like a cultural, a culture war issue in the Hellenistic era. It seemed to be, you know, a taboo of some sort in the Iron Age, but not quite as taboo. The long answer is it's multifactorial. It seems to be tied up to economics. Pigs are very much an urban animal that is living in filth, eating your garbage all the time. It's also tied to economics, where pigs don't have a lot of byproducts that tie well to wealth. So cows have milk, sheep have wool. So we have a lot of evidence of temple institutions in ancient Babylon and ancient Mesopotamia having large amounts of sheep and cows as ways of to generate wealth and for generational wealth, but pigs, not so much. You can get meat, not so much milk, not so much wool. So there's the textile industry, not there, milk industry, cheese industry, not there. So it's tied to economics, just less popular. And the whole theory that it had something to do with like parasites, like it's just completely not the case. Like, ancient societies around the world ate pigs as an important part of their caloric intake. So why did the Greeks and the ancient Chinese who ate pigs, why did those civilizations go on to be great civilizations, even though they were eating pigs? So it really had nothing to do with parasites, possibly economics, possibly intercultural, as a way to distinguish yourself from a neighboring culture. So the Philistines ate pigs, Israelites didn't. Israelites and Philistines were rivals, so there might have been some way to distinguish between the two. Short answer is it's a long answer. Multifactorial, not parasites, though.
I'm really interested in this thing that seems to happen, which you've kind of talked about it across a number of videos, whereby two religions or just cultures come into contact, and this... Because intuitively, right, from a naive perspective, you expect two cultures come into contact, and as a result, they meld, right? You know, there's more cross-cultural exchange. You expect to exchange ideas, and obviously that does happen. But some of the most interesting things I think you've talked about has been where two cultures meet, and it immediately intensifies both of their particular cultural rituals, the things that set them apart from one another. Why is that? Is that normally because there's some kind of hostility between the two cultures or pre-existing religions, and it's a response to that? Or is it something that cultures more widely tend to do when they encounter kind of the other, for lack of a better term?
Yeah. I mean, this is a huge, huge topic that's hard to parse. My first thought might be to push back a little bit. There's this phenomenon of the narcissism of small differences, where the two groups that are very, very similar might fight the hardest.
You know, wow, okay.
Protestants between Calvinism and Arminianism, like whether you're predestined to hell or not, and like those two Protestants agree on everything, They're Protestant. They have the same Bible. They might call their religious leaders pastors instead of priests. Like, they might believe in everything except for this one predestination issue, and they fight so hard about it. So the narcissism of small differences sharpens the difference between these two groups. Meanwhile, the Protestant apologist is not on stage fighting a Hindu apologist. Like, the difference is too vast to matter. So that would be one example where the different cultures clashing are actually quite similar. What I think we see more often is what we would call syncretism, which is more of a fancy term for the mixing and assimilating we see between cultures. And we sometimes think of syncretism as like two big cultures just melding, a paganism over here and Christianity over here, and they kind of mix and create this hybrid. And that's just not really what happens on the ground. But you have people on the ground who interact with a new religious idea for the first time, and they can choose to reject it or to assimilate it. And it's kind of this picking and choosing phenomenon that happens. You can use the word bricolage, which is the fancy, I think it's from Levi Strauss, an anthropologist, do it yourself. Syncretism is do it yourself religion, bricolage, where you're kind of putting together your religious world with the available materials. And if you're an indigenous Egyptian living in the hinterlands of ancient Egypt, and you're very used to Osiris and Horus, and then suddenly you have this new guy on the block who has the good news about Jesus Christ and this person named Mary, and we can go to this building called a basilica and do the Eucharist, you can choose to reject it or try to incorporate it into your religious world. And that looks different into different communities, into different people. And you get these interesting, we could call hybrids. But the example that comes to mind, in ancient Egypt, you had these things called ticket oracles. You go to an oracle and they would give you a ticket, like, hey, should I move to Philadelphia or Chicago? And they would give you, you know, ISIS says go to Chicago. It was kind of this interesting, like, you know, wow. The priests are behind the scenes facilitating the oracle. And these ticket oracles just get completely Christianized. They've been going for thousands of years, but now it's the saint, you know, Saint Anthony or whatever, giving out the oracle instead of some Egyptian god. And there's this famous monk, Simeon the Stylite, who would sit on top of a pillar. This was Syria, not Egypt. And he would sit on top of a pillar for like decades. And this practice also seems to have come from before Christianity, where it just kind of gets Christianized. So sometimes it goes both ways. So a practice is adopted or Christianized. And that's what I see more often. Your initial question was about cultures meeting. That's something that I see more often is the melding and mixing. I've seen the phrase creolization. You can think of Creole languages. It's a linguistic term where you have Haitian Creole, where the French language and West and Central African languages interact from enslaved Africans under European rule, and you get this interesting language, Haitian Creole, which is neither French nor African. It's its own thing, and you get kind of creolization in religions as well, where communities and people and mix and match to create what is not fully Christian but neither fully pagan. It's like its own thing.
Well, I mean, that is a much more heartwarming kind of picture of how things work. So I'm glad to have been corrected on that, because I much rather the situation where different cultures meet one another and there's this kind of much more friendly sort of exchange of ideas. That is very nice.
Not necessarily friendly either. Like, it can also it could be syncretism under pressure, where the local monk also destroyed your temples. It's not supposed to be Pollyannish, but I think to bring it back full circle to something we talked about earlier about a centralized religion, like, oh, the essential Buddhism is the Buddha and this particular text, and no religion is an essentialized distilled. So cultural phenomenon, like all religions are mixing and matching and assimilating from the cultures around it. Christianity itself, you can point to any segment of Christianity, whether it's a liturgical practice or a sacred text or a particular ritual, and you can find a lineage or a genealogy to how the idea was inspired. Like the Eucharist, for example, coming from Greco-Roman banquet culture, where you would come together and you eat bread and wine, which were like the staples of your typical dinner banquet back then. And then this becomes sacralized into what we know as the Eucharist today. Eventually, from the sheer number of Christians, it could no longer be a banquet. It had to be smaller amounts of food and wine. But there's, these are as a religion that grew in the ancient Greco-Roman world, of course it's going to draw beats from the ancient Greco-Roman world and ancient Judaism.
Yeah, I always think about Christianity in the context of Greek philosophy, just as the era I'm more familiar with, and how much of what we now think of as quintessentially Christian theology is really inspired by Greek, like Neoplatonism. Mm-hmm. Just kind of, it's incredible swaths of what we now think of as, you know, Augustinian and well, we don't even think of it as Augustinian anymore. We just think of it as Christian theology. Yeah. Is directly of the lineage of Plotinus and the thinkers that came immediately before him.
Yeah.
It is what we do have this instinct to kind of try and essentialize, I think is a really good word for it. Would you just recommend that in order to kind of counter this urge, we start to think of things more as, you know, functional or as evolutions of contingent processes, and that's a kind of much more productive way of thinking about where our thought systems have ended up? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, more recently, a debate that an argument that's come up a lot in certainly the UK and the US in recent years has been this, you know, we've kind of called it the Tom Holland argument, whereby, you know, Christianity is seen to have inspired this and this, and, you know, is the foundation of our particular moral makeup, sometimes the term used. And obviously, on one level, that's true, because Christianity has been a dominant intellectual and social force in Europe and North America, well, at least in Europe, for hundreds and hundreds of years, and for North America, at least hundreds of years. And so there's a sense in which it seems trivially true. On the other hand, it seems like the load-bearing philosophical part of this is to do with conceiving Christianity as this one essential thing, and that actually by breaking it down into contingently evolving parts and not seeing Christianity as this thing that began with Jesus and seeing it, you know, it actually draws from prior traditions and it evolves out of something as well, just as secularism, or what we now call secularism, evolves out of Christianity. This seems like it's a way of potentially diffusing some of these, what I would at least consider to be slightly more simple historical takes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be prescriptive necessarily, but I would say if you want to engage in the academic study of religion from a critical perspective, you, in many respects, you historicize it. So in the line of scholars like Foucault, where you don't, this is what I meant by treating religion as special. Don't treat religion as special, treat it as human phenomena that we call religious, that we can see in other arenas of human thought that are historically contingent, that claims to the sacred, calling something sacred, is a human construct of somebody, an authorizing community saying this thing is sacred. And so this is the critical study of religion, where it doesn't mean that you have to be an atheist to study religion, but I am studying it naturalistically. I'm not engaging in speculation about the existence or non-existence of the supernatural when I say, I don't know what example we want to use, but like the day of Pentecost, where the Holy Spirit comes down and all the apostles start speaking in tongues, I'm going to treat that as a historical text that was created by humans, influenced from a particular historical and social context, and not treat it necessarily as a sacred text in the sense of that it's divine. So this is the critical naturalistic study of religion, where we describe what we see, but we also re-describe what we see. And by that, I mean we look at the Nicene Creed and then re-describe it as a communal ritual that is a credibility-enhancing display where Christian communities gather and together chant their cognitive assent to particular truth claims, and in so doing increases their social bonding between members. You know, that's a sociological redescription of what many Christians consider to be this, you know, distillation of truth, of Christian orthodoxy. So again, that doesn't mean the critical study of religion is an atheistic endeavor. I'm friends with many scholars of religion. It's people who I hang out with, and they're all different types of theistic and non-religious, theistic and religious and non-religious perspectives. Is just a particular method for approaching this data, and the first and foremost is treating that data as human. That this is at some point produced by a human, we can set aside the question of whether it came from God or a God before then, but like at some point the Apostle Paul put pen to paper, and he is operating under, you know, Stoicism or Platonism. Mm-hmm. We can identify his inspiration. And one of the more eye-opening moments for me was reading the Dead Sea Scrolls for the first time. And you're like, oh, so much of this sounds Christian. And you can then suddenly see where Christian apocalypticism came from, where you have Jews that were saying, oh, the Messiah is going to come from the line of David and fight against Gog and Magog. And like that's in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then you go read the book of Revelation and you have Gog and Magog fighting against the Messiah from the line of David, where these ideas are historically and socially situated. And what I encourage people to do is to ask critical questions that sometimes seem to be impolite, but it's just trying to get at the human side of these questions. Like, who wrote this? For whom? With what agenda? Who wins if this work persuades the audience? Who loses? So pick up the Apostle Paul. Who wrote it? For whom? What's he trying to persuade of them? And you start seeing the human side of these texts. I'm focusing on, you know, biblical texts right now, just because that's my own subfield. But you can ask that of anything. There's the historical critical study of the Quran, which itself is a growing field of study, which itself is controversial. But this is what the critical scholar of religion does, which is approach these practices and texts and mythologies and communities as data. And that sometimes feels uncomfortable. And in the same way that when anybody, you know, tries to study you and explain why you're doing what you're doing, it can feel uncomfortable. But this is, I encourage people to treat the academic study of religion as we would any other field, whether it's history or archaeology or anthropology or neuroscience. And this is what makes religious studies so great, is because it uses all the methodology from all these disciplines, and we just happen to apply it to this thing that we call religion.
Mm. Yeah, so I suppose similar to how you know, you can read up on the neuroscience or the psychology of love and still find yourself very much still loving your partner.
Yeah, I think that's a really good example. Like, you know, you can explain psychologically, and you can explain the hormones for like why somebody fell in love and married their spouse. And you can just analyze it, and oh, it was because of these hormones, and you happen to be acculturated into this particular society at this particular time, and you can completely, you know, suck the magic out of it, but that doesn't necessarily make it any less meaningful to that person that they're married to that particular person and they love them and they would give their life for them. Like, that's kind of the same with religion, where it's like, I'm not necessarily questioning or delegitimizing your deep, powerful connection to this community or to this tradition, but I'm just going to explain it in the same way I'll explain like hormones and primate monogamy when explaining human marriages.
Amazing. And just to wrap this up, this has been absolutely wonderful chatting with you. I always ask people this at the end of every interview. What's the most interesting idea you've come across in the past year or so, and why?
The most interesting thing recently is a book by the historian Francis Young, who wrote a book recently called The Silence of the Gods, the untold story of Europe's last pagans. And I study Christianization, but I'm always focused on like the late Roman Empire. So I'm studying Egypt, I'm studying Syria, I'm studying Asia Minor, like the corners of the Mediterranean world that were Christianized very early and relatively rapidly. But he wrote this book about the Lithuanians and the Latvians and the Estonians and the indigenous
peoples. Much further away, I suppose.
Much further away, more remote, further from the cultural epicenter of the Roman Empire. And these communities, these people groups didn't Christianize until 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. I mean, he has historical documents of people worshiping like a grain god in Estonia in like the 1920s. So like absolutely fascinating corner of Christianization, where Christianization stalled or slowed down significantly in some of these further reaches of the continent, where we think of, you know, Europe as a mostly Christianized continent by the Middle Ages. It was not fully Christian, if we can even use that word, fully Christian. What does that even mean? But you had these communities that were not particularly Christian, as we would define that, as well into the modern period.
Wow, that's absolutely fascinating. And finally, where can people find you? I'm sure that many people already know, but just in case.
Sure, you can find me at Religion for Breakfast on YouTube. I'm also on TikTok, Instagram is Andrew Mark Henry. And yeah, come for religious literacy and the critical academic study of religion.
Amazing. This has been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.